This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today we're talking about Freemasonry. We've talked about it many times on Dreamland, and the same issue always comes up, and we'll discuss it later on as to the conspiratorial aspects of it, whether or not it's a dangerous secret society, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think so, obviously, or I wouldn't have Masons on the show, and I think very much the contrary. Today we're going to be talking to Mark Stavish. He's an authority on Western spiritual traditions, and I can assure you this is true because he has written 26 books published in 9 languages, including another book which I have also read called The Path of Alchemy. And as you know, we had Prince Stash DiRola, who is a great alchemist, on Dreamland a few weeks ago. And The Path of Alchemy, I think Prince Stash would agree, is a fine book. Egregores, and we can talk about what an egregore is as we get into this, because it's such a mysterious word. He's the founder and director of the Institute for Hermetic Studies and the Louis Claude de Saint-Martin Fund. He has appeared on many shows, including our friendly Coast to Coast AM, which I'm going to be on again soon the next few weeks. Now, he's been on the History Channel, the BBC. He's even been discussed and featured in the New York Times. But that does not necessarily mean he's wrong. Anyway, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you with us. And I think we're going to have a wonderful time with The Path of Freemasonry, the craft as a spiritual practice. I would like to start out with a little bit of the history of Freemasonry, because I think you know this story really very well. And why don't you tell us something about the first times it appears in the record, not the legends, but in the record?
Wow, that's a question in and of itself, because that's always being revised. I think what we do, and I like to show this, is we look to the founding of the United Grand Lodge of England, and that was in 1717. Now, what that means is to have a United Grand Lodge meant that there had to be other lodges prior. And if I remember correctly, even the date, now think about that, that's 300 years ago, but even that date of 1717 may have been recently revised to 1715, I think, because of some records. So this notion of when is the first Masonic lodge, and when we talk about Masonic lodge, we're maybe thinking as in Freemasonic, that's pretty much anyone's guess, because there's a period of transition when we're going from what are called operative lodges, that is lodges, which are essentially union halls of men who work in stone, to these kind of philosophical lodges where they're opening the doors to anybody. You know, they're going to let anybody in this club. And it's folks who are interested in what Masons do. Well, that's the question. Why are these hoity-toity folks and even, you know, a lot of what we have as professionals and middle-class folks, why are they interested in what Masons do? What is the Masonic secret? What are they after? And many people have come to believe, and I am among them, that it was mathematics, geometry in particular, and the fact that these men could travel. So they had news of other places.
So, yeah, and they were literally, when we say Masons, they were they were craftsmen, essentially.
Correct. Correct.
What about the Regis manuscript from the 15th century, as I recall, that refers to masonry as a craft, doesn't it?
Yes, and we see it because a lot of these manuscripts do refer to the craft in terms of a physical craft, as in to create or manufacture or produce something. But remember, within that framework, there's always a certain philosophical view of where one fits into the cosmos. None of these crafts existed as we think of them today. If someone says they're a writer, I always refer to them as a child of Hermes. And often they look at me confused. Well, you know, if you're a writer, Hermes is your patron deity. That's your god. Same if you're in banking or finance. So if you were to look at any of these crafts, each of them had their own patron saint, because the world was still a somewhat mysterious and we could even say metaphysical place. So you as a craftsman would have a patron saint, you'd have patron holidays to that saint, and you would have a place in God's universe.
And this is what they lived for and what they built the Gothic cathedrals for, is this place in the universe. Is that true? Is that an accurate way of describing the way these people who were craftspeople thought of themselves in those days?
I can't say it was universal, but more of them probably did than now. And the reason is very simple. They were imbued in a metaphysical worldview from the time of their birth to the time of their death. I think one of the finest documentaries on this is a movie that's probably 30 years old now called Cathedral. And it's a partially animated, partially live production. And it talks about the production of a cathedral, but it also shows the worldview they lived in. And of course, you know, the churches weren't always filled with holy men. There was corruption as well. And there was shakedown for money.
There still is. That hasn't changed.
Right. You know, and that shakedown for money was to finance some of these cathedrals. But at the same time, that aside, there was a tremendous amount of devotion and a tremendous amount of piety at different times. So we see people looking at their work, and within that framework of that work, a sense of connectedness to something bigger. And this is really important, because that bigger was cosmological. It was sacred. It was divine. And we see that's probably one of the biggest things missing today, is people looking for a connection. Now, they look for a connection, but where do they find it? How do they find that connection to something bigger?
Well, exactly. And this is a big part of what this show is about, because this is a show that goes to people who are on spiritual journeys and exploring spiritual journeys, many of whom have been turned on to this by extraordinary and unusual events in their lives, like I had, that sparked the writing of Communion and my entire spiritual journey that has taken place since. So, you know, we're very open to this, but we keep the experiential side of our lives to ourselves, pretty much. And I'm not going to go into that here, because this is not your area of expertise. But what is the journey itself. And I want to ask you, before we go on too much, a little bit about your own journey, where you started in Masonry and why it became so important in your life.
Well, I joined Masonry about 20 years ago. I'm shy of celebrating my 20th anniversary of being entered, passed, and raised. And it came to me because I was running an esoteric group, and we were having quite a few folks coming in from New York and Philadelphia to it. That the group was in northeastern Pennsylvania and just south of Scranton. And quite a few of the folks were Masons. And they always asked me why I never joined. And I said, well, I just haven't gotten around to it yet, and whatever excuse I could make. And then finally, one of them, who was a very good friend, I said, well, okay, you've made your point. I've put in my petition to a lodge, and they all came in for it, and we made a great couple of nights of it. So my entrance way to Freemasonry was very different. It came in by way of, well, not so much different now, different then. Now we see more young men joining Freemasonry because they're looking for something esoteric. I was not. I just wanted to have the Masonic experience to see what that was all about. And it's quite worthwhile, by the way. However, we see more young men entering it because of a belief in an esoteric view and esoteric teachings. A lot of it has to do with Dan Brown, even though that itself is going on 20 years. That has a lot to do with it. At the same time, that is part of the Masonic revival movement that's happening, that the chicken dinner, fish fry, and as terrible as this sounds, but terribly average view that we see in many Masonic lodges and Anglo-Saxon Masonry is fortunately giving way to a more vital Masonry, which is more philosophic, more esoteric, and in that way, much more in line with its 18th century origins, European origins.
I know that there are two streams in Masonry. When I was a boy, I was a Catholic, and we were not supposed to join the Masons, which is probably what made me interested in them. And I met and talked to some Masons who were in my hometown of San Antonio, and it was very much the fish fry kind of thing. And it was also segregated, both men only and whites only. And that was true, I guess, in a lot of lodges in the South, but it wasn't congenial to me even when I was young. Especially the whites only thing was not acceptable to me. And I know that's no longer true at all, but I also want to ask you about, as the craft moves back into its original form, which is a philosophical organization devoted to basically to inner search in pursuit of ways of serving the good on the externally. What about women? I know that the core Masonry is still males only. Where do we go here? Where are we going to take this?
Well, there's really nowhere to go. And the reason for that is simple. What is called regular Masonry is a man's only organization for a variety of reasons. At the same time, there is co-Masonry, which is of men and women. There's Droit Humain. There are some only female groups of Masonic groups. The question is size. These are often smaller organizations. And can I, as a regular Mason, associate with them? Well, there were times when, if you did, it would be pretty much instant ejection. Now, people don't really care so much. There's more of an ask, don't tell. But the problem is, when we talk about Masonry, we're talking about a very large tent. So within the United States alone, we're talking maybe 51 grand lodges. Yeah. I don't want to think about that. You know, it's not as if you can say there is a Masonic singularity imprimatur like you would have with from the Catholic Church. It's not that monolithic. So, you know, even within Masonry, there's considerable differences. So what we have are landmarks, and those landmarks are what we identify with both nationally and internationally as something being regular Masonry. I don't really see any reason for regular Masonry to change. It doesn't have to, because if people want to, I encourage them. I actively do this. And look, grandmasters read my books. I mean, there's no secret to my stance on this. I'm very vocal about it. We need more philosophical Masonry. We need to more traditional observance lodges. And we need to be more open. And that means if members of regular Masonry want to join, you know, Droit Humain or Co-Masonry or something else, they need to feel free to without any repercussions. And, of course, that changes from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And often people don't tell. People know. They just don't care anymore. It's not a big deal. So I think some of that view, there's what's on the books versus what really happens. There's bigger concerns than whether someone is going to another lodge like that. But those lodges are free to grow themselves. I think that's my point. They're also free to grow themselves.
Right. I understand. We're talking to Mark Stavish. His new book, The Path of Freemasonry, The Craft as a Spiritual Practice. His blog is Vox Hermes. And where would we find your blog?
Oh, just Google it. It's at WordPress. And
we just Google VOXHERMES and we get there, right?
Correct. Or just Google my name. You'll get lots of stuff. And Institute for Hermetic Studies, Google that too.
Well, Free Dreamlanders, we'll be back in a moment. And before we go, subscribers, I would like to ask all of you to tell your friends about Unknown Country and Dreamland, because we need subscribers. The COVID situation has caused our new subscriptions to drop way off. And so if you have friends who are interested and you think who may benefit from this wonderful website and its content and Dreamland in particular, please let them know, suggest to them, or you can give them a gift. Just go to your account and click on gifts and you can do that. Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back. It seems that in-person conferences are finally coming back. I'm going to be at the Conscious Life Expo February 4th through 7th at the LAX Hilton near Los Angeles Airport. It's going to be quite a conference. I'm going to be talking about my new book, about them, a deep look into just who our visitors are through the medium of what they do. It's going to be a very interesting talk, I can assure you. A lot of friends are going to be there. Jacques Vallée is going to be there. Jimmy Church is going to be there. George Noory is going to be there. It's quite a big group. Bashar will be there. I haven't seen Bashar in a long time. William Henry, Linda Moulton Howe will be there. All kinds of great people. Adam Apollo is going to be there. Alan Steinfeld will be there, all kinds. It's just a wonderful lineup of extraordinary people. So go to ConsciousLifeExpo.com and you'll be there too. We'll see you at the expo. I can't believe after all this time, I am finally able to say those words. Where is the unknown country? Is it out there in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. UnknownCountry.com. There's no place like it in the world. Before we left the air, Mark held up a wonderful coffee cup. We all need to see it. Can you hold it up again?
It's sealing it.
There she is, the owl, symbol of many things. Can you talk a little bit about her, about the owl?
Oh, geez, it's so much. It's really all the great, deep, dark, and mysterious things of the night, of the unconscious, and those psychic forces. That's my understanding of it. And also, the owl is misunderstood. The owl is a terrific predatory bird. So it's also those really deep, aggressive forces within us that we need to survive in the darkness, that we need to survive in the unconscious realm as we bring it into consciousness. So that's the way I look at the owl, and I just love it. I think owls are really fascinating birds, fascinating creatures.
Well, of course, those of us who are in the close encounter experience are deeply involved with the owl because the our experience, my first initiation into this journey that I'm on started with a confused memory of an owl. And this is commonplace in this experience, which is not necessarily about alien contact. It's about externalizing an inner search in the context of some very powerful questions, I would think. But in any case, we really share your recognition of the owl, and this goes all the way back in human history. Athena's the great goddess of Athens, she was both the goddess of wisdom and the goddess of battle, and her symbol was the owl for that reason, because the owl is both a predator and a source of wisdom. All right. Now, you in the book, I want you to explain the book a little bit, because the book is a really useful tool. It's not just I don't want to give the impression to my listeners that this is just sort of another history of masonry. This is a tool that you can use whether you want to be a mason or not. Now you emphasize that in the book. Can you tell us exactly why it is that you explain that it's useful to anyone?
Well, the book was written to help Masons in many ways better understand masonry, because depending on which jurisdiction you're in, you may not have a good education on that. Education can simply become a matter of learning rituals, and that's about it. So that was one aspect of the book. And as I was writing it, what I noticed is what I'm really talking about is a worldview, a path of self-development. How do we improve ourselves? And within masonry, we talk about the seven liberal arts and sciences, or the trivium and quadrivium. And what do they mean to us today? Well, when we think about it, all of these things are useful. How do we learn to reason or logic? How do we learn to speak or rhetoric? How do we learn about our place in the cosmos, which is astrology or astronomy, depending on who you look at? What is the importance of geometry? Well, you know, everything we have is because of geometry. The technology we have, the buildings we're in, all of this is a function of geometry on some level. So better understanding yourself and your place in the universe is really what masonry has the potential to offer you. But it's not just masonry. You don't have to be a Freemason to have this inquisitive and explorative worldview. So when I wrote the book, I took it through, you know, what are symbols and rituals and the ideas. And then I asked questions and I gave suggested readings and exercises you could do. And one of the most interesting ones is having to do with how does one memorize all these different ideas? Well, we've heard of the art of memory and how you identify ideas with symbols and lock them into a physical place. Others is how you would draw them on the ground in chalk for the ritual work. This is something we all can adapt to our own lives in our own unique way, so that we can better explore what it means to be human. What does it mean to be myself? And how do I improve myself? Because at the end of the day, Freemasonry asks one question. And it occurs in what's known as the Chamber of Reflection. It's a very famous aspect of Freemasonry that isn't always used anymore. But I encourage your listeners to Google it and see some images of the Chamber of Reflection. Because it asks one question, why do you want to join masonry? Well, when I give a presentation on it, I change that to, why are you here?
That's because a much bigger question.
But it fits within the Masonic context, because when the Chamber of Reflection was used, being a Freemason was a death sentence in some countries.
Yes.
So why are you here? Why do you want to join this organization? And that's where it begins to expand into that much bigger question. Why are you here? Why are you in this lodge tonight? Why are you with this group? Why are you on this planet? Why are you here? And that's the question we need to ask and answer for ourselves.
Of course, underlying that question is the great question from the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. Know thyself. Know thyself. Yeah. A remarkable question. And how do we find the answer? That is, I think that's the basic path of Masonry that you're talking about, in a sense. And I thought to myself as I was reading the book that the journey toward the good is the journey of self-understanding, because you have to know yourself in order to know how to project yourself in the world as an advocate of the good. So,
well, I think that's it. Know thyself. And this is what the younger men coming into Masonry want. They want the philosophical and esoteric aspects because they want to know, they want the answer to that question. How do I begin to know myself? And in the book, The Path of Freemasonry, we explore that within the Masonic context, but by no means is it exclusively Masonic. It is a human experience, and it is how that human experience was particularly realized in Western culture and within the Western framework over the last 300 or so years, or slightly more years. So really since the Renaissance, from the Renaissance on. So it is really to help us reinvent ourselves. The book is a way of how to help us reinvent ourselves and, in some respects, our sense of culture with it.
Yeah, when you say our sense of culture with it, what do you mean exactly? That's a very interesting statement in the context of our discussion.
Well, we have different cultures. I mean, we often think of our culture today in terms of just what we see when we go out, whether it's Walmart or McDonald's or something of that nature, or what we see on Netflix or Amazon. That's in some ways culture, and it's a pop culture, and it's immediacy culture, but there's cultures of longevity, and there's our own culturation. Do you consider yourself a cultured person that is refined, intentional? Culture is intentional, and I think that's a good way to describe it. We are making decisions which we have thought about. Remember, logic and reason and rhetoric. We've discussed them. We've contemplated them. We've considered their cause and effect. What is the effect of this in the future? And I undertake this action because I believe it will be in my best interest. And it can be something as simple as forming good habits or wearing the right clothes to an interview. One of the most fascinating things we see about Masonry is that for many young men, it is the first time they've been required to wear a suit and tie to anything.
Yeah, I know that I used to wear suits and ties everywhere, and now I don't anymore. They've gone out of style.
But they love it.
I agree.
Because it says this is special.
Right.
This is important. I need to pay attention to how I project myself into the world, because now how I project myself is a reflection of how I think about myself. I mean, Freemasonry is really, in many ways, the earliest continuing education self-help movement. I mean, it really had those qualities to it for generations.
If a young man or young woman, or older man or woman for that matter, wants to join Masonry now, but not the fish fry Masonry, the Masonry mm-hmm. you're talking about, where do they start?
Well, that's a little difficult, and I'll tell you why. First of all, women are going to have the advantage, and because if they join co-masonry, which is or something like that, there are other variations of it. But I think if they go to if they Google co-masonry and they go to the official website for it, which is in Colorado, they'll see a list of different associated Masonic groups that are very esoteric in nature. So they're going to have a certain advantage. I'll tell you that. They're a higher demand organization in many ways. And men can join that too as well. If a young man is joining Masonry, he's going to have a little bit of a trouble because he's going to have to look around in his jurisdiction, and he's going to have to find a lodge that he's comfortable with. But he probably will not find everything he's looking for. And then within that jurisdiction, he's going to have to reach out and find where the traditional observance lodge is and probably have dual membership. However, for myself in Pennsylvania, let me say, we only have two of them, one near Allentown, one near Pittsburgh, neither of which are extremely close to me, although Allentown is closer. And what we have is a tremendous educational program. The Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania, and of course any Mason can join this regardless of jurisdiction, they have a tremendous educational program that you can do online. And twice a year, they have the Academy of Knowledge, which I spoke at. And those are very esoteric in terms of presentation. So the philosophical and esoteric aspects are there. You're just going to have to look for it a little bit. And of course, and I've been brought to task for this, but I'll say it more in a more informed way. Generally speaking, the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite, of which Arthur Hoyas wrote the introduction to my book, is a spectacularly educated organization. They are phenomenal.
And where is it when you say southern?
That's located in Washington, D.C. and covers 35 states, I believe. Then there's northern jurisdiction, which is out of Massachusetts, which I'm in. It covers, I believe, 15 states. The problem was for many years, northern jurisdiction was not very philosophical. It wasn't very demanding. I understand that the current Grand Master, friends of mine who've been raised to 33s have told me the current Grand Master has a great educational program. I've gone online to look at it. So our jurisdiction is turning around. My point is, if you are a young man or an older man and you are in Freemasonry and you want to meet up with other men who have philosophical, esoteric interests, you may not necessarily meet them in your lodge, but I guarantee you it will not take that long to find them in other lodges and in other activities if you just know which words to look for and go online, because the internet has made so much of Masonry accessible to other Masons, not just non-Masons, but Mason, the Mason communication is just booming and in a really good way. Yes, there's always some troublemakers. You know that. There's always someone who's always unhappy and complains. I'm not talking about that. I've met just wonderful, wonderful people, courtesy of exchanges that we otherwise would not have had from social media or email.
Well, we live in such a time of deep division that we have to learn how to live with one another. And I have friends on every side of the part of the political spectrum, and I'm always, and my website, of course, is not political. And it's, I mean, spiritual search isn't political. You can be a spiritual searcher. G.I. Gurdjieff had in his group in Paris in the 1940s, there were both Jews and Nazis, and they worked together very successfully inside the group. And after the war, because he had had connections to these Nazis, he was about to be condemned as a collaborator until they discovered that he had also protected Jews and saved a number of them from being deported. So we are, what I'm saying here is, we are above this. Our work is above the whole political spectrum. All spiritual search is. It simply isn't part of politics. Politics comes and goes, but we're still here and still asking that same question of ourselves. Know thyself. Mark's book is The Path of Freemasonry. His, I guess, blog is Vox Hermes, VOXHERMES. You can engage with him on his blog, or better, get the book, and because the book will take you through the whole process, the beginning of learning this great tradition, Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back.
Did we misunderstand the teaching of Jesus? Perhaps a long time ago, perhaps almost as soon as he rose from the dead, we mistook him for something that he may not have been. But we do know one thing. He was one of us. His life and his resurrection reveal the power of the good in all of us. And his teaching shows anybody, whether they have religious beliefs or not, how to find that goodness and live it. Get Jesus a New Vision. It's available as an audio book. It is available as a paperback and as a Kindle. Get it today. This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010 talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia.
Here you are in South Sulawesi in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I work with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started.
There are wonderful groups of questions in the book, and I'd like to. This first set is taken from material by Charles Mertz. And who was Charles Mertz? He wrote a book called Ask Me, Brother.
Well, that I can't answer. I read his book, but it's not his biography.
Okay. Well, obviously, he knew a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm sure what you can do is enlighten us about some of these wonderful questions. Now, these are questions about not the actual known origins of Masonry, but about its traditional or legendary origins. But they're very important to anyone who is interested in Masonry as a spiritual practice and a philosophical practice. And I'm going to just go through a few of them. beginning with, I guess the best way to talk about it is the significance of Alexandria. He starts, that's his first question. And what is it about Alexandria that's so important in Masonry, in esoteric Masonry?
You know, when you look at Freemasonry, almost all of the rituals, particularly those which we consider Blue Lodge or entered Fellowcraft and Master Mason, entered Apprentice, Fellowcraft, Master Mason, those degrees focus around the building of the Temple of Solomon. So the building of the Temple of Solomon is the focal point of so much of what we do. But in other Masonic degrees that are after that, which are considered explanatory degrees or exploratory degrees of the Masonic concepts, we see other ideas brought in. One of my favorites was always the Tower of Babel, but you also see Alexandria and Egypt. And of course, because the men who were writing these degrees were often very well educated and they understood the importance of Egypt within the classical framework. So Egypt was seen as the place of all wisdom. And of course, we're here having this on the Feast of the Epiphany, which is the Three Kings Day. It is the day when my great uncle, who was deeply involved in occultism and esotericism, he was born in 1900. And of course, the three kings brought three gifts to the newborn Jesus child, Christ child. There are different stories that say after that, when of course Herod was going to slay the children, of course we call that the slaughter of the innocents, that Mary and Joseph and Jesus fled to Egypt. And that you see wonderful paintings coming out of the Belle Epoque of Mary and Jesus resting between the paws of the Sphinx. So this association of Egypt with wisdom and magic and esotericism is deeply rooted in the Western framework. And of course, the Greeks and from that others believe that everything great came from Egypt. And of course, the Hermetic revival, not revival, because of the origins of Hermeticism, take place in Alexandria when we see the last surviving aspects of the Egyptian temple period, Gnosticism, some variations of Jewish mysticism, early Christianity, probably even some Buddhism and some Indian yogas or tantras in some form, all mixing together in Alexandria and creating this wonderful thing we would later call Hermeticism in its various forms. So Alexandria is very important for that, the notion of a center of learning and of great wisdom.
How would you describe Hermeticism?
Hermeticism is the survival of classical Egyptian beliefs into the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, having a period of revival in the late 19th, early 20th century to the present. And those beliefs we consider or focus primarily around practices of alchemy, astrology, and to some degree Kabbalah, but what we think of as ceremonial magic or esoteric or ritualistic practices.
And you engage in these practices?
That is correct.
I don't want to disturb, I know some of this is probably private, I'm not trying to pry, but at the same time, what of these practices work for you, and what energies do you gain from them? And I know it's a general question, but it has to be, because I'm not sure exactly what you do.
Oh, well, sure. Well, first of all, we have to understand energy is the key to everything. If we don't have the juice, we don't get anything done. So it's really understanding what is that relationship between energy consciousness and matter, or energy consciousness and symbols, or like with astrology, it's consciousness, energy, and cycles. So we're always in some way trying to engage what is this relationship between energy and awareness, and then how does that fit in? So whenever we engage in any kind of meditative practices or visualization practices, we're engaging in that aspect of energy consciousness and symbols to some degree. Okay. Even if it's not symbolic in the traditional sense as we think of it, but something even very literal and concrete, it's imaginative for us. So it allows us to enter into or engage the unconscious in the imaginal realm. And that imaginal realm, at least if we look at the great Renaissance practitioners, particularly Giordano Bruno, that is the gateway to everything. The imaginal realm is that hinge point, that porch point between the inner and the outer realms.
I was going to bring up Giordano Bruno when you talked about memory, because, of course, he has left behind an amazing system of memory where you can use it and the evolutions of it to build a very, very good memory. Now, Bruno was murdered by the Catholic Church. Can you tell us a little bit about Giordano Bruno and his importance?
Well, you know, he's a figure that people should at least be superficially aware of because he played a pivotal role in cosmology. And the general belief is that his execution by the Inquisition and burning alive was done because of his cosmological views. Rather than so-called religious views. And that may be an area that is something for scholars to nitpick about or to examine. It may not necessarily be something the average person finds important today, but at that time, it was critical. And I think that's important to understand. At that time, it was an important notion. What he left us in terms of what the listener, your average listener, can be interested in is this notion of the role of memory and the imagination. And he kept alive the classical art of memory. And the art of memory is how do we remember things? And of course, the classical orator, and we said in masonry, the ability to speak properly and to speak at length is an important part of the work, as is memorizing these extensive rituals that we have to learn. And they're often learned from mouth to ear. You don't have a script to go from. In some instances. So you hear someone say it, and then you have to learn it and repeat it back and go through that process. So memory is very important. And memory is really the key to our existence. It's what allows us to, when we say someone is intelligent, what we're really saying is they have a good memory for the most part. they remember a lot of ideas and facts and can possibly then re-coordinate them into new possibilities or effective solutions. So his art of memory is very important. But with it was the role of the imagination. In the post-Reformation period, we see the notion of the importance of the imagination being degraded and distrusted. Whereas imagination, prior to that, was the key to the invisible realms. You see it in all of the magical texts. We see We see that in all new thought. We see that in New Age thinking. We see that in Tibetan Vajrayana. We see that in Indian Tantra. How we utilize our imagination decides and defines who we are and what we become.
Now, you're going to have to expand on that, but you're going to have to do it after our final break. Free Dreamlanders, it seems that in-person conferences are finally coming back. I'm going to be at the Conscious Life Expo February 4th through 7th at the LAX Hilton near Los Angeles Airport. It's going to be quite a conference. I'm going to be talking about my new book, about them, a deep look into just who our visitors are through the medium of what they do. It's going to be a very interesting talk, I can assure you. A lot of friends are going to be there. Jacques Vallée is going to be there. Jimmy Church is going to be there. George Noory is going to be there. It's quite a big group. Bashar will be there. I haven't seen Bashar in a long time.
William Henry, Linda Moulton Howe will be there. All kinds of great people. Adam Apollo is going to be there. Alan Steinfeld will be there. All kinds. It's just a wonderful lineup of extraordinary people. So go to ConsciousLifeExpo.com and you'll be there too. We'll see you at the expo. I can't believe after all this time, I am finally able to say those words. We're talking to Mark Stavish, the path of Freemasonry, the craft as a spiritual practice, and we're beginning to go quite deep into this whole realm of the craft and its spiritual significance. Whether you're a man or a woman, you can explore the craft, and we've talked about that a little bit. You can also reach Mark on his blog, Vox Hermes. And just before we continue on, can you repeat a little bit about how to engage with the craft? I know we've said it before, but I want to say it again, just so that people who are thinking about it have it in their minds.
Well, to engage with the physical aspect of the craft would require contacting a Masonic entity from men. That would mostly be what we call regular masonry, a local lodge or a grand lodge in your area. For women, it would mean probably going online and looking up something like co-masonry or female Masonic lodges and connecting with those and finding out one where one is locally and getting involved. And that's the physical connection. The spiritual connection, the deep philosophical connection comes through the procedures outlined in the path of Freemasonry, in which we begin to look at what is the role of symbolism in our lives? What is the role of architecture? What is the role of the environment we're creating for our mind and body? And then how does that affect us? And that is in some ways a reflection of what we would have seen in both Indian art of placement or Chinese feng shui. We see that in the Renaissance with the notion of how do we create specific environments for specific outcomes. Ficino was big on that in his Three Books of Life. The environment we create physically becomes a expression of our inner life. It affects our inner life. What we expose ourselves to changes who we are to some degree. Therefore, we have to be very careful and selective in those things we expose ourselves to. And that's what I mentioned earlier about the notion of culture and creating an inner culture. At the same time, we can use our mind to create possibilities. If we don't always have something available to us in the outer world, we can always create it within our inner world through the power of imagination and bring it to reality at some point in the future. So the power of creativity and doing so in a manner that is harmonious and beneficial to ourselves and to others and allows us to become a building block, a smooth ashlar, if you will, in the temple of deity for the benefit of all beings is what Masonry is about.
In the temple of deity for the benefit of all beings. What an interesting, complex statement. When you say the temple of deity, what do you mean?
Well, in Freemasonry, we use the term grand architect of the universe, and that can have different meanings. There's only one Masonic entity that does not require belief in a supreme being, and that is the French Grand Orient. The others have some kind of litmus test. The question is, what does a supreme being mean to you? And therein lies one of the great questions. It's a very personal answer. So you're asked, do you believe in the existence of a supreme being? Well, okay, yes, I do. But you're never asked, what does that mean?
I have studied the Templars extensively. And I think that what they brought out of Egypt or out of the temple in Jerusalem, was probably a system of architecture from the classical world that was used, I would think, in the creation of temples, especially such temples as the Temple of Athena on the Acropolis in Athens, which is as esoteric a design as anything in any architecture in the Western world, and that this evolved into the skills necessary to build the cathedrals. And paralleling this practical level of knowledge, which would have been a level of mathematics and geometry that had been lost in the West at that point, is a spiritual journey that is like the journey that emerges out of the Gospel of Thomas, which is a hidden mathematical journey, very much. It doesn't seem like it on the surface, and it's got a lot of different surfaces, that particular gospel. But what role does this play in our journey toward the divine? Because I know you have some very interesting responses to this question. What is the math of the sacred, and how do we find it in our lives?
Well, one of the somewhere it said in the beginning, God geometrized. You know, God used geometry in the beginning. You know, we go from 1 to 2 to 3, and we have a whole series of various numerological schools telling us what these numbers mean and how they relate to us. We see them symbolically related, both in terms of ritual structure format, but also into whole philosophical and ideological statements, whether it be the Trinity as it exists in Christianity or in other forms, whether it be the 10 spheres of the Tree of Life, or whether it be the 7 planets. And then how do these relate to us as individuals? Because remember, the ancients were looking for this notion of as above, so below, microcosm and macrocosm. How do I relate to the cosmic? So, you had 5 fingers on each hand. So each one of the fingers had an aspect of an element as well as a planet. All of this has to do with a deep cosmological view. Well, as a walking temple, that is, an individual being is a walking temple, that individual being would unite with other beings and create things, might build a house, might build a church, whatever. And in that creation, some of these philosophical ideas would always seep through. Okay. Whether, in terms of what does this represent? So we see the use of numbers, both in a very practical sense of measurement, of measure and order, but also that order then is expected to reflect a divine order, some kind of divine harmony. And that's why when we look at classical structures, when we look at these classical buildings, these churches built during the post non-apocalyptic frenzy of the 10th century, and of which, notice how so many of them are Notre Dame, they're to Our Lady, to the Mother of God. That's a very important point to note.
And also more deeply to Mother Earth, perhaps.
Yes, they're built often over sacred wells or sacred sites of some kind.
Right.
There's a rich history within those that we see talked about in the 20th century by Fulcanelli, the anonymous Francophone, we're not sure if he actually was French, but Francophone alchemist who wrote The Mystery of the Cathedrals. And how does the symbolism of the cathedrals relate to the alchemical process? So all of that required an understanding of harmony and number and formation. So numerology had a very practical sense in terms of measurement, but it was understood not just as kind of a symbolic way as we might today, like what's the number of your name, but in terms of a very real expression of the presence of deity, of divine force in this physical world.
of defined force in this physical world. You know, I've always thought of the temples and the cathedrals in the same sense, is that they are intended to connect us, the is it were the intelligence of the earth, to the higher level. As above, so below. Between them are these temples and these sacred places all over the world. And the sense of a lost world is always there, because if you look at the very oldest sacred sites on earth, the ones that have been inhabited the longest, you find them on a geodesic line that doesn't point directly north. It points to a direction about 1,450 miles west of a current true north, as if once the planet wasn't askew. Once it was, things were different, and now they are askew, but we can find balance, and maybe this is all about finding balance. Now, I want to return briefly to the three gifts of the Magi, which are a very important concept because they relate to the trilateral name of God, and this is one of the questions in Mr. Mertz's Ask Me Brother, the group of questions you published of his. And I think it's a very important one. The sounding of Aum, for example, can you tell us a little bit about that and the significance of the trilateral name of God? This is a deep show because a lot of people on this show are really deeply into spiritual journeys. So I'm sorry if I'm these questions are a little more challenging than you have received before.
No, this is a great one because it really puts Mertz and Masonry at that time in its cultural place. Yeah. These were well-educated men. These were well-learned men. And if you take a look at the various Masonic encyclopedias from the period, they are deeply written and deeply filled with esotericism. And a lot of these folks were coming out of the occult revival period. They were knowledgeable in theosophy. There was an explosion of interest in Eastern philosophy at that time, particularly Vivekananda was well known. And into the 20s, we begin to see Yogananda. So there was a deep knowledge and appreciation of Eastern philosophical views, which, of course, was primarily yoga-oriented. They really had no knowledge of Tibetan or Chinese views at that time. So Aum, of course, becomes the mantra that you see a lot of Indian swamis are using to begin to bridge that gap. Because they talk about the four sounds of Om. There's Ah, Ooh, Em, and then silence. So we talk about, you know, the nature of deity, the three aspects of the Trinity. So it becomes a bridge point for philosophical discussion. Now, of course, you're going to find many professors of theology and comparative religion who will dismiss these points, but the practitioners were unconcerned about that. The practitioners are looking at how to make sense of this on a personal and internal level. So Masonry, if we look carefully at it, is also one of the earliest forms of comparative religious studies. And late 19th and early 20th century, this becomes very prominent because, well, all we have to do is look at the writings of Albert Pike.
Yes, tell us.
Albert.
Wait a minute, folks. I have bad news and good news. Good news for subscribers is this is going to get really interesting in a few minutes. It's been interesting all along, but we're going to go very much deeper in the next half hour. The bad news is for you free dreamlanders. Now's your chance to make the decision. Subscribe to Unknown Country, and you can stay with us through the whole show and not listen to a single ad. Free Dreamlanders, goodbye for today. Subscribers will keep right on keeping on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.